your daily dose of debate, breaking news, and uncensored views. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And in this great nation, of course, the entire coronavirus crisis has been tough, really tough, on virtually every American. But there's one American who has just written a book, and it's about much tougher times and much tougher lessons. And lessons that should help us right now in this moment of decision and crisis for our country. I'm talking about Congressman Dan Crenshaw of Texas. And you know him. You've probably seen him on television. You certainly have heard his voice. He is one of the leading and new conservatives in Congress. You would recognize him for the black eye patch. The black eye patch is not there because he's a pirate. It's because he was severely wounded serving our country as a Navy SEAL in Afghanistan. And the book in part, the book is called Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. And Dan Crenshaw, when you were writing this book, were you expecting it to come out in the middle of a pandemic?
No, that was certainly not the plan. Of course, if I had known that April 7th was going to be in the middle of the pandemic, well, I would have a crystal ball, and I'd be the oracle of our time. So, no, it's definitely not the ideal moment for a book to come out. But in another sense, in a more optimistic sense, these lessons, I think, are genuinely helpful to people. I think these are exactly the lessons we need in a time like this. It was written for the more menial, petty outrage culture and microaggressions that we find ourselves in our daily lives, but the solutions to those problems are the same solutions to real problems too, and I think there's a lot of lessons that people will take away from this. It's not what people think. It's not. I think it'll be a lot more unique and creative than you might have expected.
Well, I agree with you. The book is called Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage. And I was surprised reading it. It's actually a very affirmative and inspiring book. And one of the things that you begin with is a group of protesters who are up there on Capitol Hill demanding that people stay outraged. I mean, right now, they're, of course, Americans are outraged about everything, you name it. Why is outrage not a particularly productive response to challenges?
Yeah, it's useless. You know, if you're purposefully engaging in outrage, if you're one of those people buying one of those shirts on the internet, which is such a strange thing, this notion that you should stay outraged just for the sake of outrage itself, the only reason that you would want to do that is for political manipulation or some other kind of manipulation, not necessarily political, but that's the only good reason. If you're not doing it purposefully, if that's just what's happening, then I think objectively speaking, we can say that's not a useful emotion. It's an understandable emotion, right? I'm not saying we're not human and that we should all be robots. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying it's important to recognize the utility of such an emotion. There is no use to it. You should always be striving to be better. And the real problem that I identify here is not necessarily that people are outraged. I mean, look across human history. The people are always mad, right? We're human. But what has changed is that we've almost started to aspire to this notion of staying outraged. Like I said, there's literally T-shirts made. Okay, we have leaders of our country tweeting it out, like Bernie Sanders, stay outraged. Like, it's becoming this, like, heroic attribute to be mad and emotional and overly and exude this kind of this passion, not the good kind of passion, but the bad kind. And that's what I have issue with. We have to get back to emphasizing the right heroic attributes. And I use the word heroic because I have an entire chapter on what it means to engage in hero archetypes and, like, basically in layman's terms, what we view as good things and what we view as good qualities in a person. That has changed. We start to see this fist-shaking activist yelling and screaming and crying as some kind of hero. That's not heroism. It's not at all. It's not who we want to be.
Yeah, what I was relating to in reading your book, Fortitude, and I'm speaking with Congressman Dan Crenshaw, is one of the most powerful lessons I've ever learned personally in Bible study, which is the question is, what is the opposite of happiness? And the opposite of happiness isn't unhappiness, it's anger. Because when you're angry, when you're outraged, when you're just ticked off, you can't see all the things you have to be grateful for. I thought one of the passages in your book that I found profoundly moving, you were reacting to the death of your mother. You were reacting to the loss of your one eye and the damaged vision in your other eye. And one of the things you were saying was, don't be angry about what happened to your eyes, be grateful for the fact that you have vision at all. And that, it seems to me, is a profoundly important message for Americans right now.
Yeah, a sense of gratitude is something we've lost to a huge extent. Where, and I often say that conservatism really is, it stands for a lot of things, but one of those things is gratitude. It's a gratitude for our founding. It's a gratitude for the things that worked that got us here, whether those are economic, cultural, or political. The left likes to undermine those things, and you see this in left-wing politics, which is convince people of a disaster, convince people they are always in crisis. Not like now when we actually are in a crisis, but I mean before this crisis. You know, convince people that their lives are terrible, convince people that somebody's oppressing them, because if you convince people of their unhappiness, well, then they're more likely to want the revolution that these political activists are trying to promote. That's the game behind it all, and we have to be mentally strong enough to recognize that. And I lay that out in this book, this prevalence of victimhood culture that has permeated our country, again, where we elevate victimhood, where people have elevated victimhood to such an extent that people fake these victim hoaxes, like Jussie Smollett. I use it as an obvious example. Elizabeth Warren is another obvious example. I mean, faking victimhood because that's the new heroic attribute. That's a crazy thing, and it's a corruption of our culture.
The book is called Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage, and it includes a series of lessons and life lessons for dealing with the era of outrage and the culture of outrage. One of the things that generally has outraged, if I can use that term, conservatives like you and me has been the growth and growth and growth of government. I was looking at a chart yesterday on the extent of federal spending right now as a percentage of GDP. And we are three times higher. We're at about 30%, going on to 35% of GDP, of gross domestic product, spent by the federal government. That never during the New Deal period, where we were facing a Great Depression and Franklin Roosevelt was such a hero because he spent so much money. The New Deal period, we spent less than a third as much. Is there any hope, Dan Crenshaw, as a Republican conservative congressman from Texas, to roll back some of this level of spending?
We don't have a choice, and we have to convince the American people. You know, we blame politicians for this all the time, but in the end, politicians are truly representing people. And even when conservatives start to talk about the need to roll back entitlements, and let's actually use the New Deal. All right, let's put it back in terms of the New Deal. The original purpose of these programs was much less expansive than what they are now. They've been expanded over the years. You know, I mean, you know, we could throw this right back at progressives and say, you know what, I am in favor of the New Deal, but I want the actual New Deal, not this new version that you've created, where we've expanded it so endlessly to where it's completely unsustainable. And it doesn't mean cutting, and they'll accuse us, you know, it means you're throwing seniors off the cliff. Like, that's such a dishonest tactic. We have to tell people that that they're being bought off with false promises. We have to explain that to people, especially my generation. You can't keep voting for a political party, the Democrats, that literally want to take your money and hand it over to somebody else. I don't see why you would vote for that. And you don't want to vote for a party that is putting us on a totally unsustainable trajectory. Now, and of course, they would point out, well, Republicans aren't much better with spending. And again, that's true, and that's why and the reason that's true is because the hard reality that a lot of conservatives need to realize is, you know, our own constituents push back when we talk about these much needed cuts, because they want cuts somewhere but not here, right? Not if it affects what they feel they're owed because the government promised them that. We all are in this together. This is an us problem. This isn't actually a one side or the other problem. You know, conservatives actually at least talk about it, but we have yet to do anything about it. And the reason it hasn't gotten done is because we haven't persuaded the American people well enough of the problem and of the solution. And I think when you said 30-35%, were you referring to the deficit? Because the debt to GDP ratio
No, I'm referring to the amount, the peak federal spending during this period as a percentage of the GDP.
Yeah.
And
I think of the, you know, possibly the deficit, because the debt to GDP ratio is astronomical. It's even higher. And growing.
No,
either
it's
way,
worse.
It doesn't really matter. It's growing, and it's growing in a huge way. One of the reasons we can't have such an enormous debt is because of times like this when we actually need to spend money. You know, we all agree we need to spend money at a time like this. We've paused the economy. We have to inject capital into it. It's much harder to do that sustainably when we already have an enormous debt. It's why we need to be more responsible with our spending.
No, which is a profoundly important point. Let me ask you this, because right now it should be a period of increasing national unity, at least in terms of determination to beat this coronavirus crisis and to get our economy rolling again. There was another time of national unity where everyone in the House of Representatives, where you now serve, voted to authorize war in Afghanistan, and mm-hmm. except for Barbara Lee of California. She's the only one who voted no. And that war in Afghanistan, you sacrificed a great deal of your life and health fighting in that war. Should Americans still care about what happens in that country?
I mean, I think we should, and there's a split in conservatives on this particular issue. What I point out to people who like to use the slogans of, you know, bringing the troops home and no more endless wars, those are just slogans. It's making the case from some sort of moral high ground that you're protecting the troops by claiming that they should come home. I think people need to realize that, first of all, we don't need anybody's protection. We do this voluntarily because we understand that there's an enemy out there that does want to kill us and does want the operational space to plan another 9/11, and if given the space, they will do just that. The problem with the Afghan war discussion, I think, is this. For too long, leaders have talked about it as if there's this winning end date, you know, as if we're fighting this uniformed adversary the way past wars have been fought. But it's really not what's happening here. The reason we continue to send troops to places like Afghanistan is a bit more of an insurance policy. It's a preventive measure because these bad guys are still out there, and every day they still do plan on hitting the homeland. The reason they can't is because we keep an eye on them, so to speak, out there, because we continue to put pressure on them. Now that's different than nation building. I think the Americans have collectively lost any patience for nation building. It doesn't work really in a place like Afghanistan, or at least not in a matter of 5 to 10 years, the way people would like it to work. It's a long-term goal of supporting our allies there and making sure that they're not overrun and just taken over by the Taliban again, which, as we recall, protected al-Qaeda while they committed 9/11 attacks. So to just give up and give that back to them, I think, would also be folly. It doesn't mean there's not some good balance where we're not investing huge amounts of blood and treasure, but while also accomplishing the mission of preventing further attacks. So it's a lot more complicated of a discussion than just bring the troops home, no more endless wars. I wish we would stop sloganeering in that way.
Amen to that. The book is called Fortitude, written by a decorated Navy SEAL and Afghan war veteran, Congressman Dan Crenshaw. Coming up right now, all the attention, of course, is focused politically on the presidential election. But there is a real shot for you and your fellow Republicans to take back control of the House of Representatives. Why is that so important, Dan Crenshaw, even assuming that President Trump is reelected?
Well, it's important because we need to get our agenda through. The radical agenda of Democrats has been on full display over the past year and a half. It's truly radical. You know, if you're Nancy Pelosi and you want to make it hard on somebody like me to vote, you would actually compromise with us to a huge extent. But they don't, right? They what they would do, if they were smart, if they were politically intelligent, they would take 80% of the bills that they put forth and just put that on the floor and make it really difficult for me to vote against it. But they don't. They put very radical things in there that we can't possibly vote for, and frankly are easy to say why we're not voting for them. They have no intention of governing. They have no intention of getting these legislative items to the Senate and to the president's desk. They have no intention of compromising.
What's an example of the kind of provision that they put in that you can't possibly vote for?
Geez, seems like all of them at this point. Let's go with a recent one that they're going to use a lot in the upcoming campaign, which is H.R. 3. This is the drug pricing bill. So on its face, they claim, hey, this is just a bill that reduces drug prices. How can you be against reducing drug prices? And for our part, we're like, well, we're not. But we need to think about intelligently how we're going to reduce drug prices. So we're in favor of H.R. 19, which is a good bipartisan bill, actually. It tackles some tough issues, removes some loopholes that pharmaceutical companies engage in, makes it easier for generic drugs to get to market, which are more, you know, to increase competition, which reduce prices. That's a bipartisan bill that could pass. But they put forth H.R. 3, which is a price control bill, because Democrats are very simplistic in their thinking, right? They want people to get paid more. They say, okay, just make them get paid more. Let's have a $15 minimum wage. We'll just make it happen. We want things to be lower cost. Fine, we'll just pass a law that says they have to be this price. Those are price controls. And to assume that there's no consequences to price controls is incredibly stupid. Incredibly stupid. But they don't care about those consequences, and they know that the simplistic, shallow arguments that they put forth can be persuasive because they're emotional. They're made based on emotion. But we know that when you put in price controls on something like drugs, well, you're going to have less of them because there's going to be less innovation. There's less incentive to actually put the billions of dollars required in the research and development to create that next life-saving cure. And the CBO had scored this, you know, up to 30 less drugs over the next couple decades. Other studies have found the same thing. This would put out of business a lot of smaller biotech firms. The big pharmaceutical companies would be fine because they make their money in other ways. But, you know, what I write about in my book quite a bit is behind every headline, behind every feel-good policy claim, there's a lot more layers to it. And an element
and
of a
you,
person
you
with,
can actually...
or a characteristic of a person with fortitude, mental toughness, is the ability to look past those headlines and look into it. One of the reasons I became so much more conservative over the years is because every time I look into a subject, it is the conservative side that actually makes a real compelling argument based on facts and reason. And on the left side, but they simply don't. It's usually shallow and usually based on some kind of emotional reasoning.
It's all emotion. We're just about out of time, but I do want to let people know that information about Dan's brand new book, Fortitude, American Resilience in the Era of Outrage, is posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. We'll also have information on how you can contact Congressman Crenshaw directly. May you continue to be strong in the fight and stay not outraged, stay hopeful, constructive, conservative, and patriotic. The book Fortitude at michaelmedved.com. Thanks so much and Godspeed to you. And happy Easter, Congressman Crenshaw.
Most of us have been spending a lot more.
The Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com.
And on the Michael Medved Show, we live at a moment where Americans can't seem to agree on anything, not anything at all, except one point of agreement for this country, whether you're conservative or moderate or liberal or you're a brokenhearted Bernie bro or whoever you are, is that the people on the front lines of this coronavirus crisis are heroes. They are heroic. They have done an amazing job. We're talking about medical professionals of every kind, and I would say nobody more than people actually running major hospitals, which have been absolutely the number one battlefield against what President Trump rightly calls a monster that we're all facing. Let me welcome back to the show the chief executive officer, Dr. Jeff Tomlin, of one of those hospitals that was absolutely one of the very first to deal with massive numbers of coronavirus cases. Dr. Tomlin is a former Marine aviator, and an anesthesiologist, and again has run this hospital that has been bearing the brunt here in Washington State, which was the first state to develop. We're also joined again by Dr. Ettore Palazzo, who is the chief medical and quality officer of Evergreen Health in Kirkland, Washington. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us. There are lots of folks who are looking at Washington State and saying, wait a minute, there's evidence that the strategy that we've been following, the battle plan that we've been following, is actually working. You're on the front lines, you deal with it every day. Have things begun to turn a corner in your estimation, Dr. Tomlin?
Good to speak with you again, Michael. I'd say this response, at least from Evergreen Health, has been in three phases. The first phase was the first response to the virus. The next phase was gearing up for the possible surge. And then this third phase that we've been in is preparing for when we can begin to care for our patients again. And regarding the preparation for the surge, we wanted to make sure we had enough equipment and beds and ventilators and all those things, and the projected numbers, very thankfully, have not grown to be as demanding as we thought. And so I think there'll be a lot of studies after this has passed us this first time to see what were the effective measures to keep those numbers down. But there's no question that I believe the response in the Puget Sound area by the citizens, some great preparation by the healthcare system here, as well as some, I think, good leadership in regards to social distancing early and a number of those things, I do think has contributed to keeping the numbers down. So I would say that we're all grateful in terms of the Puget Sound area healthcare organizations that we haven't had the numbers that were first projected. And Dr. Palazzo can tell you a lot about the most recent modeling.
Dr. Palazzo, what about that? Is there's an indication that, though of course this entire pandemic is horrible and it's disastrous and no one should downplay it, but the most recent modeling gives some encouraging perspective, doesn't it?
Thank you, Michael. It does indeed. We've been watching these modeling numbers very closely from the beginning, and as the data has been entered into the various modeling structures and informed the modeling, it's helped both our organization and the region as a whole have an understanding of how these mitigation strategies potentially would decrease the burden and resource need on the hospitals. And we were very excited over the weekend to see the most recent data update suggesting that for Washington State, we may have passed the peak resource need from a healthcare standpoint, with the Institute for Healthcare Evaluation and Metrics suggesting that April 2nd was the peak date of resource use for our state. And again, that was predicated on these mitigation strategies to help reduce the spread of virus.
And in terms of the patients that you are treating right now, who have tested positive. Have any of them benefited from this very controversial, much discussed use of the drug hydroxychloroquine?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think the short answer to the hydroxychloroquine question as far as benefit is we just don't know yet. There are limited what we call in vitro or lab studies as well as anecdotal case series that have been reported suggesting benefit of this particular medicine with its anti-inflammatory effect for patients with COVID-19. With the experience from China, but those really rigorous randomized controlled trials to really tell us if this is better than, say, placebo just aren't out there yet. But knowing the severity of illness that some of these patients come in with, we at Evergreen, like other organizations, have put together a protocol under the guidance of our infection control team to use the medicine in select cases based on severity of illness with the hope that those patients will potentially receive some benefit. But we just simply don't have the data right now to say how effective in our population the medicine is.
Would I be wrong, Dr. Palazzo, in assuming that you think this should not be a political question, one way or another, whether you're for or against? It should be a medical scientific question.
I absolutely agree, and I would use that tenet on any decision we make for COVID-19 or any other, that it really comes down to what do we know, what's the science tell us, and helping use that information to guide us.
In terms of the death number of deaths in the state of Washington, they keep revising downward the modeling and the projections, which is great news. But there's been some question that's been raised about the classification of people who succumb while suffering from coronavirus. Are some of those people who may have died from some underlying condition while they had coronavirus, do you make a distinction when it comes to reporting cause of death?
Right. So there is a protocol for documenting all of this, of course, and the other comorbidities or associated diseases that individuals have that may have been stressed or caused worsening as a result of coronavirus is documented in how we at Evergreen list cause of death or even during standard discussion. If there's a clinical condition, whether it's related to the heart, the kidneys, the liver, an association of coronavirus or anything else needs to be included in that discussion. And that's how we frame any of the description of what we think the cause of death was associated with our patients.
Speaking to Dr. Ettore Palazzo, he's the Chief Medical and Quality Officer of Evergreen Health in Kirkland, Washington, which has had as much experience as any American hospital in treating coronavirus patients. Why? Because the pandemic came first to the Seattle area here. And thank God we had doctors like Dr. Jeff Tomlin, the CEO of Evergreen Health, and Dr. Palazzo, the Chief Medical and Quality Officer, there on the front lines. When we come back, I want to get an update on one of the heroic doctors who was written about in the Seattle Times, who was right there at Evergreen Health on the front lines, and he himself tested positive for COVID-19. What is the update on his health, his situation? And then I know that elective surgery was suspended at Evergreen Health. Has that been renewed? Will that open up again? We'll talk about that and much more, and the perspective for the whole country coming up on the MedVed Show.
Michael MedVed. Michael Medved Show. All across America, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And we began the last segment talking a little bit about unity and appreciation for healthcare workers like Dr. Ettore Palazzo, who's the Chief Medical and Quality Officer for Evergreen Health in Kirkland, Washington, and Dr. Jeff Tomlin, who is the CEO. He also happens to be, by the way, the father of my indispensable producer, rockstar Greg Tomlin. Gentlemen, in terms of the example of the member of the staff at Evergreen Health, one of the physicians who was actually treating patients who developed COVID-19, what's his situation now? How's he doing?
Well, thank you for asking, Michael. The physician actually was fairly open with his team in the emergency department about the fact that he'd become ill, and yet there's the sensitivity around protecting his privacy through this. And so grateful to the media and others that haven't pushed further on that. But he was in critical condition in the ICU for a period of time, and we're very happy to report that he actually went home and has continued to recover at home. So I can't tell you how excited we are about that.
Well, thank God. By the way, let me ask you too, and I know it's a great distance and you haven't examined the patient, but that should be encouraging news for those of us who have been concerned about the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, Boris Johnson, too, right? I mean, if he has stabilized, he's 55 years old, he should, God willing, be okay, yeah?
I think it's really hard to predict, Michael, and obviously we don't know a lot about the Prime Minister's other personal health information, but in the previous segment we talked about patients with multiple medical problems, and in fact the average age of those that have not survived here in our organization is 77 and a half years of age, and so when you ask, you know, what was really the cause of death, particularly in that very vulnerable age group, it can be anything that can tip a person over. It can be a hip fracture or influenza. And so we've, I think, learned here that it's highly dependent upon the health of the person going in. Thankfully, our physician was a very healthy person, and he looks forward, I think, to telling his story more at some point.
I'm sure we all look forward to that as well. You had suspended elective surgeries because of the expected surge of patients at Evergreen Health. Are you either there or close to there in terms of allowing elective surgeries again at the hospital? And why is that so important?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, we were concerned about preserving our protective equipment for staff because we weren't sure if the surge was coming or not, what the demands were going to be. We continue to not do electives. We're doing urgent and emergent cases that would include cancer patients and such, or emergencies that would come through. We are preparing for what that will look like in the future in terms of all those patients that have put off those procedures that they need to have. And so a lot of planning around that, how to do that safely, certainly how do we test patients as they come in to make sure that they don't have COVID coming in? How do we make sure that as a staff we're keeping patients safe as well? So there's a lot of planning going into this, and I suspect at some point when we get ready to do it that they will start in small tests of change. We can do this safely.
I think one of the encouraging things that a lot of Americans have seen has been the ability of people to work together across political lines, even across regional lines. I mean, I think it was inspiring that when Governor Inslee was able to send 400 ventilators back to the federal government because they weren't needed here. Have you been working closely with other hospitals in the region, and how has that helped the situation?
The governor early on identified the need for all of us leaders in healthcare organizations through the state to work together. And so I am really pleased to say that with the help of the Washington State Hospital Association and the leadership there, that we are on at least weekly calls, sometimes more often, to talk about the very things that you've alluded to, Michael, in terms of what's everybody's status of PPE, how many ventilators are available, who has intensive care unit beds. And so Dr. Palazzo can tell you a lot about that because he's been submitting data daily to the to really the Department of Health and to the state.
Yeah, Michael, just to expand on that a little bit, we, along with our weekly calls with the Washington State Hospital Association and representatives from the governor's office, we have a daily call with all the regional hospitals sharing our learnings, sharing how to coordinate resources. As we were preparing for the surge, we understood that there may be some hospitals that were more burdened than others. So how would we be able to move potentially patients and resources throughout the region? And so a mechanism has been set up through a regional coordination center that allows for that, and I'm very grateful to say that at this point it looks like that won't be necessary, but we are, based on the modeling, but we are now set up to be able to do that, and the efforts of all the organizations being able to come together to do this in a short period of time has been quite remarkable.
Let me ask you this. In terms of the mask debate, the great mask debate, do you urge people, your patients, maybe who are there in the hospital for other reasons, or the public in general? Yes, masks, no masks, masks some of the time, not all of the time. Dr. Palazzo, what's the position?
Yes, so we've been watching this very closely as the information has unfolded. Again, just like the medication question, we look to see what the data and the science tells us, and this is one that is a bit challenging. We would like to have definitive evidence to say, especially if we're talking about using a resource like masks and other PPE that is in short supply, what is the best way to help protect either the individual or the healthcare providers working with them from a mask standpoint, and then what should happen in the community. So we have done our best here at Evergreen to consolidate all that information, and we have moved to an extended mask use policy for all of our healthcare workers that allows them to have masks even if they are not directly in patient care areas where we have COVID or COVID-suspected patients, so that we can honor those decisions that have come forward, noting full well that there's not a lot of science behind some of this right now, and that will likely come later. But we want to do our very best to protect everyone, including our patients and our staff caring for the patients.
Let me ask you in conclusion, each of you, and Dr. Tomlin, you first. It's impossible to know what the future is going to bring, but I'll bet you that both of you have already started thinking about what you will remember most from this crisis, which I know is one of the biggest events, biggest challenges in your lives. What do you think? What will you recall when you look back on this, Dr. Tomlin?
Yeah, first and foremost was the response of the team here that just really met this head on. They just selflessly just went to take care of these patients and didn't panic, began problem solving right away. So certainly the team here and their response, number one. Number two is the outpouring of support from the community. I can't tell you how many people have reached out to us in terms of donations of protective equipment, food donations, contributions in terms of money and other things. It's just how the communities come together. You know, we've worked with people like Microsoft and the University of Washington and CDC and Department of Health. And as Dr. Palazzo said, I think the learnings that are going to come out of all the studies that have happened here and around the country, it's just been amazing to see how people have come together.
How about you, Dr. Palazzo? What will you look back on most about this period?
Michael, I think what I will reflect most on is the fact that this approach, whether it's at Evergreen or in the region, the state, and certainly nationally, as much as we know here, is that there has been an outward-looking approach to dealing with this. I think human nature would say, even at the individual level, what does this mean for me? How do I protect myself? How do I protect my own organization? And that's a natural thing to want to do. But to combat this, to do this in a concerted effort, it really has to be everyone in it together and sharing thoughts, resources, sharing learnings, and being able to do that in a timely fashion. And that's what has happened here. This is what I will never forget.
You two great medical professionals have exemplified that. That's Dr. Ettore Palazzo, Chief Medical Officer, and Dr. Jeff Tomlin, the CEO of Evergreen Health, who have been a credit and a life-giving force for this greatest nation on God's green earth.